Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to our weekly EAN podcast. My name is Barbara Tettenborn. I am the editor-in-chief of eLearning, and besides that, the head of Department of Neurology in St. Gallen, Switzerland. This month, our EAN cast has movement disorders as topic of the month. And on my side for the moderation of today's podcast is Yildiz Digimenci, who is in the editorial board of eLearning and a movement disorder specialist. She just came back from the International Conference on Movement Disorders in Madrid, and she can introduce herself now for maybe one or two sentences.
Thank you, Barbara, and hello to you all. I'm a movement disorder specialist and the leading movement disorder specialist at the Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorder Center of Istanbul Medipol University. I'm currently working in Istanbul, Turkey. I'm very glad to be here with you all today.
Thank you. And in the first episode today, we are talking about the etiology and diagnosis of Parkinson's disease. And our very valued guest of today is Professor Matej Skorbanek. He holds currently a position of Associate Professor and Head of Center of Rare Movement Disorders at Department of Neurology in Košice, Slovakia. And he received his PhD title in 2014 at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands and became Associate Professor shortly thereafter in 2018. During his specialization, he attended study stays at universities in Prague, London, Groningen, and Vienna, and he is the current chair of the movement disorder section of the Slovak Neurological, as well as the chair of the MDS European Section Educational Committee, and of other national and international working groups and committees. His major clinical and research interest is also related to early diagnostics of rare hereditary hyperkinetic movement disorders, and I'm very happy that you could find the time today to join us. So welcome, Professor Skorbanek.
Thank you very much for the kind introduction. Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here today.
So we can start our little talk of today, and maybe Yildiz wants to start with the first question to our guest.
Okay, great. Thank you, Barbara. And we are welcoming you, Matej. Thank you for being us here today. Just to start with, as we know, Parkinson's disease is a global health problem leading to many disabilities in due course of the disease, and it has a growing prevalence worldwide. So to recognize the disease, to diagnose the disease, how can you describe the Parkinsonism symptoms for us, please?
Thank you. So Parkinsonism is a syndrome. Terminologically, I think it's really important to differentiate between a syndrome and a disease. So we always start phenomenologically from Parkinsonian syndrome, which is defined as presence of bradykinesia or hypokinesia, so slowness or low amplitude of movements combined with rigidity and or resting tremor. So this is sounds easy, but in a routine clinical practice, this is the source of many problems because, as we have seen in the past papers or meta-analysis of neuropathologically confirmed cases in community settings, the diagnosis of Parkinson's disease may be wrong in up to 30 to 40%, which is really a huge percentage. In most cases, this is because patients with other forms of tremor are misdiagnosed as having Parkinson's disease, but the problem is that these patients usually do not have bradykinesia, which is actually the core clinical criterion for saying that someone has Parkinsonism. So saying that someone has Parkinsonism, we can go further into the differential diagnostic workup.
Speaking of the further diagnostic workup, just before that, if you would like to exclude the symptoms or the features that can lead to other Parkinsonism syndromes rather than idiopathic Parkinson's disease, what would you consider and tell us about the red flags in terms of conditions and features?
Okay, so once I diagnose a patient with Parkinsonism, my first question always comes to whether this is a classic idiopathic or genetic Parkinson's disease, or it's another form of Parkinsonism, something like atypical Parkinsonism, sometimes called as Parkinson plus syndrome, or a secondary form of Parkinsonism. So Parkinson's disease usually starts relatively with an insidious onset. We typically have very good effect of medications if they are tapered in correct doses. Whereas if we go to the other neurodegenerative conditions, which comprise the atypical Parkinsonian group, what we typically see is a very fast progression, a much faster progression than one would expect from idiopathic Parkinson's disease. These patients very commonly have early falls, early freezing, early bulbar syndromes, early cognitive impairment. So all symptoms that may be present in Parkinson's disease, but definitely not in its early stages. Usually it will be present after maybe 10, 15, 20 years or even later. What is very typical and tells me that this is probably not a patient with Parkinson's disease is ineffective therapy. This is, however, problematic in some of the patients because we see quite commonly that physicians don't go into sufficient doses with medication. So in order to say that someone is not responsive to dopaminergic medication, I would suggest to taper up to 1,000 milligrams of levodopa for at least 1 month. If we don't see really any major improvement in patient symptoms, then I would consider this as ineffective.
Okay, so that's very interesting to know. That will also be our next session on the therapy then, but that's in the next podcast. Today we want to concentrate on the diagnosis and the etiology. And I sometimes get confused that there are often several names used. It's either morbus Parkinson or Parkinson's syndrome, Parkinson's disease or idiopathic Parkinsonism. Are they all referring to the same disease entity, or are these names referring to at least slightly different diseases? Maybe that's for especially the non-movement disorder specialists a very interesting question.
Yeah, so this is really a very good question, and I think there is really a lot of terminological chaos around us. So it's really important to differentiate between a syndrome entity and a disease entity. So first, I always start from Parkinsonian syndrome. And then my second question is, if I see a patient who with some sort of Parkinsonism, whether it's a patient with Parkinson's disease, the classic or the genetic form, or it's a patient with some other form of atypical or secondary Parkinsonism. So saying that, in classic Parkinson's disease, I should have presence of Parkinsonism. There should be no exclusion criteria, things like cerebellar ataxia, vertical gaze palsy, and others. Patients, in order to get the diagnosis of Parkinson's disease, should have some clinical supportive criteria, but they will never be present in the first examination, things like good effect of medication or development of motor fluctuations, and especially dyskinesia later on in the disease course. So in my first examination, I concentrate more on symptoms that would point to some other atypical or secondary Parkinsonism. So these are things like fast progression of the disease, progression much faster than one would expect in classic form, with early falls, early freezing, bulbar syndromes, early cognitive impairment and dementia. And then, of course, ineffective therapy, dopaminergic therapy. So in terms of atypical Parkinsonism, we have different entities with clearly defined diagnostic criteria, like dementia with Lewy bodies, where the core feature is dementia, accompanied by some of the other core features, including major fluctuations in cognitive functions, hallucinations, REM sleep behavior disorder, or Parkinsonism, which does not have to be present in DLB. Then we have multiple system atrophy, typically presented with major autonomic dysfunction combined with Parkinsonism or cerebellar ataxia. These two belong to the group of synucleinopathies. And then we have two disorders which belong to the group of tauopathies. So progressive supranuclear palsy, defined basically by a combination of different ocular motor dysfunctions, especially vertical gaze palsy, postural instability, akinesia, and cognitive dysfunction, and corticobasal syndrome, which is defined by a combination of basal ganglia syndromes, especially very asymmetrical myoclonus and or dystonia and Parkinsonism, with cortical symptoms, especially apraxia, cortical sensory deficits, and alien limb syndromes among the core ones.
And then we have a so-called Parkinson plus syndrome. Isn't that true? So in which respect does that differ from morbus Parkinson or idiopathic Parkinsonism or the symptoms you just described?
So Parkinson plus syndrome is a term which we have previously used to label all of these atypical Parkinsonism syndromes. So atypical Parkinsonism and Parkinson plus syndrome is basically the same group of entities. So that's all this dementia with Lewy bodies, MSA, PSP, and corticobasal syndrome. These all fall within this category of disorders.
Are there any clinical signs which more or less exclude an idiopathic Parkinson's disease and rather lead to the diagnosis of another movement disorder?
Yeah, sure. So these are especially syndromes including clear cerebellar ataxia. It's never present in idiopathic Parkinson's disease. Downward vertical supranuclear gaze palsy, cortical sensory loss, ideomotor apraxia, or progressive aphasia, among others. So these symptoms point definitely to an atypical or this Parkinson plus syndrome etiology, if not explained by other medical condition.
We are all having the advantage of becoming older. I more or less learned during my residency that Parkinsonism is a disease of the elderly. But how frequent is Parkinson's disease in the younger ones, in the elderly ones, and are there any regional differences or differences in gender?
Yes, so Parkinson's disease, the prevalence of Parkinson's disease would be around 1% at the age of 60 years. With advancing age, the prevalence is clearly increasing to approximately 3 to 5% at the age of 85 years. But we have also a subgroup of patients where Parkinson's disease can start in a very young age. So we call that early or young onset Parkinson's disease. And about 5 to 10% of all cases start before the age of 40. Most of these cases will be genetic cause of Parkinson's disease. So we can talk about that more later. In terms of regional differences in Europe, it seems the prevalence is relatively even and high everywhere across the continent, with slightly higher prevalence in males than in females. The ratio would be around one and a half to one in European populations.
What is the age of the youngest patient you have ever seen with Parkinson's disease? You mentioned just there are patients under the age of 40 already.
Yeah, so it depends whether we think about Parkinsonism in a more complex disease, where I have seen a number of children with Parkinsonism at the age of 4 or 5 years, or we are talking about a phenotype of Parkinson's disease. And the youngest patients I have seen, I've seen several patients who started with Parkinson's disease around in their 20s, some of them even before at the age of 17, 18 years.
Do they have a shortened life expectancy then, or do they age more or less like the others with the medications we can use today?
So if patients start so early, it's nearly in every case a genetic condition. So then it very much depends on which gene and which disease that would be. But for the classic types or the classic young onset Parkinson's disease based on Parkin, DJ1 or PINK1 genes, it seems that the disease progression is much more slow than for patients who start with idiopathic Parkinson's disease in their later age. What is quite typical, these patients very commonly have more dystonia, more dystonic symptoms. They very commonly even start with dystonia rather than Parkinsonism. And they usually quite early develop early fluctuations. And these patients in many cases are really good candidates for deep brain stimulation therapy. So in terms of lifespan, it seems that these patients must not necessarily have a significantly shorter lifespan. So their disease goes more slowly, but in a way with more fluctuations.
Since this age group is very important in evaluating the patients with Parkinson's disease, in terms of young onset Parkinson's disease, how do you suggest our audience to screen them, evaluate the patients, and which paths, which diagnostic algorithms that they should use to evaluate and assess the patient with the young onset symptoms, speaking the patients below 50 to 40?
Okay. So once I am sure that my patient has Parkinsonism and I'm thinking about juvenile Parkinsonism, I would definitely, in cases which are not very clear, go for a DAT scan or for some sort of a functional imaging, like a DAT scan or a rectopa PET based on availability. I would definitely do a brain MRI because a brain MRI may show differences between all of these different genetic conditions. And I would go either for a genetic panel for Parkinson's disease genes or for a more complex whole exome approach, or nowadays even whole genome approach in certain projects. But in terms of genetics, there is a very large international initiative of called the GP2 project, which is doing a lot of genetics even for parts of the world where there is not an efficient or not a good access to this kind of investigation. So if you have patients which you think may have a genetic background, but you're not able to make a diagnosis, there are certain global initiatives which can help you in this effort.
Oh, thank you so much. I was trying to ask that. I was wondering that in a patient with young onset Parkinson's disease, is it okay to look for Wilson's disease screening, for example? If it is a young onset Parkinson's disease, should exclude it to give the audience a message. Maybe we can...
Oh, sure. So there are many, So there are many conditions which look like Parkinson's disease, but they are not Parkinson's disease. And they may have a completely different underlying cause, like Wilson's disease that you have very well mentioned. So excluding Wilson's disease in every movement disorder patient under the age of 40 or 50 is really very crucial. What we actually see more is undiagnosing young onset Parkinson's disease. And this is an issue because for many physicians, Parkinson's disease is a synonym of older age disease. So if they see someone who is 20 or 25, they commonly think it's something completely different and they don't even think this could be Parkinson's disease. Actually, most of my juvenile patients were not diagnosed for many years until they reached the center. So this is a common issue. Then, of course, we have other genetic conditions like DOPA-responsive dystonias, which even may well respond to levodopa, but they are not based on brain neurodegeneration. So the number of other genetic conditions which may come with Parkinsonism but are not Parkinson's disease is ever expanding, and we have a number of conditions which can present with this phenotype.
You just mentioned that there are a number of conditions. I suppose that also all these secondary Parkinson syndrome because belong to these syndromes. Could you maybe mention a few of the typical secondary Parkinson syndromes which are or should be known by everybody who is taking care of patients with movement disorders?
Yeah. So definitely the most common one would be drug-induced Parkinsonism, which we see quite often, especially in psychiatric patients treated with neuroleptics. So that's something I hope everyone keeps in mind. The second form, which is quite commonly diagnosed, is vascular Parkinsonism. And I know that in some countries, this condition is clearly overdiagnosed. So if we think about vascular Parkinsonism, usually it would present either with this lower body Parkinsonism with dominant gait apraxia, or the other form would be a strategic lesion in the basal ganglia leading to a typical unilateral form of Parkinsonism. So I would say these would be the two most common ones. But we have other forms like infectious. We have patients with normal pressure hydrocephalus, which may in some cases look like some sort of Parkinsonism with this gait apraxia and cognitive decline, but is a treatable condition, so definitely should not be missed, similar to Wilson's disease. Yeah, so I would say these are probably the most important ones to think of.
And, this
and
is
toxic,
very,
of course.
I'm sorry. This is a very good point to address that there can be some conditions that can mimic idiopathic Parkinson's disease, as you very well detailedly examined that one. But I was wondering about that. If the people, for example, general neurologist, not movement disorder neurologist, sees a patient with lower body Parkinsonism, what should they think? Would you please give us some clues about that too?
Okay, so lower body Parkinsonism, well, the term Parkinsonism is not absolutely correct because in most of these patients, it's not really Parkinsonism. It's more of a frontal gait apraxia rather than Parkinsonism. But if we see something like that, we have generally three conditions to keep in mind. So one of them would be normal pressure hydrocephalus, a treatable condition, so definitely not to miss with the classic trias of gait apraxia, dementia, and urine incontinence. The second one, which I would think of, is vascular Parkinsonism. And the third one would be progressive supranuclear palsy. And there is a subtype of this disease called pure echinesia with freezing of gait. So PSP, pure echinesia with freezing of gait. So these would be the three conditions where this would be the most common.
Thank you, Matej. These are directly very good clues to help the people to use in their daily clinical practice. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, I think we had a really interesting talk, and at least I learned a lot as being not a real movement disorder specialist, as opposed to Yildiz and Matej. So I hope that the audience took a lot of this podcast today. Maybe as a very final question, in the prevention of Parkinson's disease, how would you see the role of a healthy lifestyle and especially a lot of physical activity in order to prevent Parkinson's disease?
This is a very good comment. So I think that the best evidence for disease prevention or disease modification we have at the moment is for physical therapy. I think the evidence is quite compelling. So active and intensive exercise, so that means at least 3 times per week, at least half an hour of intensive exercise where these people will sweat a bit and breathe a little harder, is basically the best they can do. Of course, the more the better. And then lifestyle, so diet. This is really important. So we know we have some evidence that this Mediterranean style of diet has some preventive effects for patients with Parkinson's disease.
Thank you very much. So I thank you all a lot for today's podcast. Thank you, Yildiz, for helping me with the moderation of today's podcast. And especially a great thank to Professor Skorwanek for being our very evaluated guest for today. And I hope to see you soon at some of the conferences. Thank you and bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you very much for the invitation. It was a pleasure. Bye-bye.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.